From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey calls for an independent prosecutor to probe possible collusion between Russia and Trump administration officials in what he calls a White House cover-up. Also today, whatever happened to Evan Falchuk's effort to launch a third party in Massachusetts?
It is about challenging the establishment. So a majority of voters have chosen not to be associated with either of the two parties. We need to build that new framework.
But now he's joined the Democrats to oppose Donald Trump. So is there any way forward for third parties in America? Plus, New Hampshire on the verge of allowing people to carry concealed weapons without a permit, despite big concerns from local cops.
My biggest concern is there's a lot of people that will be carrying firearms concealed that really shouldn't be.
We'll talk about America's long love affair with lethal self-defense. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with the latest news out of Washington, where Democrats and even some Republicans are calling for more extensive investigations into Russian involvement in the 2016 presidential election. This follows the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn after he made misleading statements about his talks with Russian officials at the end of last year. Among the big questions, did anyone else in the Trump White House know about those talks? And if so, when did they know about them? Appearing with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today in Washington, President Trump said he's most concerned about the leaks that preceded the firing of his national security advisor.
General Flynn is a wonderful man. I think he's been treated very, very unfairly by the media, as I call it, the fake media in many cases. And I think it's really a sad thing that he was treated so badly. I think in addition to that, from intelligence, papers are being leaked, things are being leaked. It's criminal action.
But Democrats in Washington say this is about much more than leaks. Among those demanding more answers is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. He's among 11 Democrats calling for the appointment of an independent prosecutor to investigate possible collusion between Trump officials and Russia. And Senator Markey joins us now. Senator, always good to have you. Thanks for joining Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on again.
So why is a special prosecutor necessary at this point, in your view?
Well, we need to be very concerned that we are very near a full-blown constitutional crisis if these allegations are found to be true. Only a full independent investigation by Congress or a special counsel or independent commission will provide the answers. Because we know already so much about how compromised our national security may have been, we have to get the answers for the American people to understand that our emissaries the Russian government were not making Russia policy first rather than American policy in terms of our national security.
So what are the big questions that you would that you want answered? What are the top because we know a lot already about Michael Flynn, the fact that he did talk about sanctions with a Russian ambassador at the end of last year, that he apparently misled members of the administration. What else do you want to know about this case?
Well, we want to know, were Trump officials informed about leaked emails that Russia stole from the Democratic National Committee? Did Russian intelligence officials promise anything to Donald Trump in exchange for his flattering comments about President Putin? Did Donald Trump make any commitments to Russia about lifting sanctions that President Obama was imposing upon the Russians? The American people deserve to have these answers to these questions, or they will have little trust that their president and his staff are not subject to Russian influence.
Now, Senator Markey, you're among a group of 11 senators who signed this letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions requesting an independent prosecutor. You're all Democrats. How likely is it that the Attorney General will agree to this request, do you think?
Well, under the guidelines of the Department of Justice, there is a standard which has to be met in order to have any official of the Justice Department make a any adjudication of a case. And that standard is that there cannot have been a close political affiliation. And it's clear here that Jeff Sessions had a very close political affiliation with Michael Flynn as part of the National Security Advisory Team. And as a result, he should be disqualified. Senator Sessions should recuse himself because of that. But if he does not, then I think that it's going to be necessary for us to ensure that the pressure is applied to achieve that goal.
Yeah. I'm curious to get your response. President Trump didn't have a lot to say about this today, but he did make that statement where he praised General Flynn as a wonderful man, who by the way, he fired, and really made the focus about the leaks, which he called a criminal action. What's your response to the president's focus on this part of the story?
What the president is trying to avoid is the reality that our security apparatus was actually trying to gather information about the Russian government by tapping into the Russians. That's how they picked up General Flynn, by tapping into the Russians. So it's not something that was deliberately, you know, constructed to go after General Flynn. It was incidental to going, you know, after Russians, and then General Flynn shows up. And what he starts to talk about, apparently, is a compromise of American security by sending a signal that sanctions will be relaxed as soon as the Trump administration is sworn into office. So they were listening to the Russians, and Flynn was talking to the Russians. And that is about as serious a charge as can be waged against any, you know, individual in our country. And Donald Trump is just in complete denial. He's trying to make it about the fact that we now know about it rather than the fact that it happened and it's a compromise of our security.
Senator, absent the appointment of a special prosecutor, there are investigations underway in Congress. Some Republicans there seem to be moving closer to the idea of deeper investigations. I'm reading today that even Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says such investigation is highly likely. Are you seeing more Republicans moving in that direction?
I think that there are now some Republicans who understand that they cannot stonewall on this issue, that that ultimately the public is going to demand a full and transparent accounting of what happened. And so while I'm sure for partisan reasons that they want to be loyal to the president, that ultimately their loyalty, the Congress loyalty, has to be to the American people. And so I do believe that the pressure is going to mount and that individual Republican senators will begin to realize that there has to be an open, transparent, and public investigation. It might take a little while, but ultimately I think it's going to happen, and we're beginning to see some cracks in the Republican position, but it could take a little while longer before everyone comes to a realization as to what does have to happen.
Right.
And I think Senator McCain, Senator Graham are already talking in those terms, because ultimately it's a love of country, not a partisan issue. And that's how I think many senators are ultimately going to view it.
Senator, one more question. I mean, all this happens. Meanwhile, how concerned are you about the disarray within the National Security Council, what that means in terms of conducting American foreign policy, national security policy?
We should be very concerned. Right now, the Russians are in violation of the Intermediate Nuclear Force Agreement of 1987, and we need a strong position on that. Right now, the Russians are still believing that they might be able to get a huge concession in terms of sanctions because of their incursions into the Ukraine. They are increasingly thinking that they might be able to cut a sweetheart deal for Assad in Syria because of the Trump administration's desire to have a closer relationship with Putin and the Russian government. So in each one of those situations, there is clearly a national security interest. And on top of that, we have American troops stations all around the Russian border in countries who are serving us and protecting us. And many of them come from Massachusetts. And so we have an obligation to the troops that come from Massachusetts, that American security is placed in the paramount position and it's not being compromised. And right now, we don't know the answer to that question. We don't know whether or not the Russians have been able to have undue influence in these critical national security areas. So that's why I'm very concerned. And it's clear that with General Flynn leaving, it's in total disarray at the national security level. And the sooner we just get all the facts out there, is the faster we'll get to a point where we can put our national security in first place once again.
Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Listeners, stay with us. More to come. Coming up, what's the future of third parties in the U.S.? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Back in August of 2014, we spoke to Evan Falchuk, an attorney and former health and industry executive who was running for governor of Massachusetts. He told us why he was running under the banner of a new political party, the United Independent Party, or UIP, which billed itself as modern, progressive, and fiscally sane.
It is about challenging the establishment. The Republican Party is down to about 11% of registered voters, but the Democratic Party is at 35% of registered voters. So a majority of voters have chosen not to be associated with either of the two parties. We need to build that new framework.
Now, Falchuk won just over 3% of the vote. That was enough to give the UIP official party status in Commonwealth. It no longer has that today, and Evan Falchuk is now a Democrat. He's given up his push to establish a third party in favor of uniting with Democrats to oppose the agenda of President Donald Trump. And Evan Falchuk joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, we want to invite you in on this conversation. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Ralph Nader about the state of third parties in the age of Trump. And we want to hear from you. Is now the time to pick sides and abandon third parties, or do you believe third parties can still be a powerful force in changing our political system? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Evan Falchuk, it's really great to see you again. Why abandon the UIP?
Well, politics has changed. And we've come from a place where it used to be this kind of left-right debate, and now it's about people that have and people that don't have. Trump figured that out, and he won. And he's hell-bent on an agenda that's going to make things worse. And so we have to have a political organization in this country that will fight for working people and for fairness and equality. The Democrats are the only organization strong enough to actually stand up to the threat of Trump and at the same time to articulate a vision that is better than what we have today.
So does that mean the idea that third parties have a role in advocating for the kinds of changes that, you know, you were talking about back in 2014 no longer have a role in America? What do you think?
Well, the bigger issue here is we've got to get people involved politically. Today, there's lower than ever rates of voter participation. People don't run for office. People don't involve themselves in their communities. And it has to change. Part of why I got involved in the first place was to do something about that and to create a vehicle for new people to get involved. So to the extent there's people out there organizing for third parties, it's a good thing that they're doing something civically engaged. But what is really important right now in the age of Trump is to make sure we've got an effective, not just resistance to what's happening, but to make sure we are articulating an alternative vision of the future.
So why the Democratic Party? And I ask that because you know, one of the things you could argue that Trump capitalized on was a Democratic Party that was out of touch with lots of white working class people in big swaths of this country.
Bernie Sanders also did that.
Yeah.
And they're both right. The difference is that Trump is a lot of talk. There isn't there when it comes to this other than a lot of really strange stuff that's undermining our democratic process, all this weird connections with Russia. Yeah. So the question is, what do we do? I believe Democrats need to articulate a new vision, a new deal for the 21st century. I think they're capable of it, but they've got to take a hard look in the mirror and realize that they need to change. So I picked the Democrats because I think that's the right platform for it. The Republicans seem to have turned into a nationalist party that's not especially interested in working people. We've got to make sure that we have a party that will stand up for those things.
Did you consider, I mean, insofar as you are a local guy from Massachusetts, a Charlie Baker-style Republican Party? That is someone, you know, sort of easy, laid back on social issues, but sort of fiscally sane, he might say?
Yeah, those
as
are...
As you used to say.
Yeah, those are good things. Yeah. But I think this is not a time for easygoing and laid back. We've got a real threat to our democratic process happening mm-hmm. right now, a crisis of serious scale, and we've got to take sides. And that's why I chose to pick this side.
Right. So what happens, just to come back to the United Independent Party, what happens to that party now?
Well, we had to get 46,000 people enrolled by November of last year. We got over 30,000. So we did a lot. We got some people elected to local office, but it switched to become a political designation after the election, which is almost the same thing as being unenrolled. And, you know, what I say to people that are in the party now is think about how to take this fight on, yeah. how to continue it. And I choose the Democratic Party as the way to do it, and I encourage people to do the same.
Is there a part of you that, I don't know, just feels a little sad that the idea of a viable third party in Massachusetts or maybe nationally just didn't seem to work out the way you wanted it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, we see large numbers of people that say they want a third party. But when it comes down to what it takes to actually make it happen, we don't see a real market for it. So, you know, the question is, you know, if we had decades to do this and we weren't facing a crisis like what Trump represents, then it's a luxury we should pursue. But right now, we've got to take these energies and put them towards this important cause.
Listeners, we're talking to Evan Falchuk. He was the founder of the United Independent Party, which he's announced he's leaving to join the Democrats. What do you think about the viability of third parties going forward? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to have you in the conversation, and we're happy to answer your questions. And let me introduce Ralph Nader. He's a lawyer, of course, author, longtime consumer advocate, and a third-party presidential candidate, most recently with the Green Party. He's also the author of his most recent book, Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think. Ralph Nader, welcome back to Radio Boston. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brooks.
So I'd love it if you could respond to Evan Falchuk in any way you want, but he's talking about no market for a third party. You know, most recently, actually going back quite a ways, you've been a real advocate of third party power. Is Evan wrong? Is he right? What do you think?
Well, I think he makes a good point that the polls show that about 65% of the American people would like to see a, quote, viable third party, end quote. But then when they go to the polls, they want to be with the winner, and they have been educated over the past to know that there's only going to be one of two winners, Republican and Democrat. The system is a duopoly. It's a rigged system. The barriers to getting on the ballot are very, very high in many states. And so the public expectation level is that, well, it's okay to have third parties. They do provide new ideas, new agendas, maybe new energy. But we know who's going to win. It's either going to be Republican or Democrat. And increasingly, with gerrymandered districts, they know who's going to win, period, not either or. In Massachusetts, a majority of the state legislative incumbents don't even have an opposing party opponent on the ballot, like
right.
I checked. And same is true in Texas.
But isn't that an argument not to waste time sort of worrying about or trying to launch a third party?
No, because they in American history, they provide different functions. In the 19th century, the Liberty Party started with the anti-slavery program in 1840. It got 40,000 votes. It never won an election, but it helped the abolition movement. And then the women's suffrage parties, the labor, farmer, populist party decades later, they never won a presidential election. Some of them elected senators and governors, especially the populist parties, progressive parties, but they changed the agenda. They were first with labor rights. They were first with government regulation of the big railroads and the banks squeezing the livelihood of the farmers. They were first with progressive taxation. They were first with the 40-hour week. They were first with organizing for labor unions, first to propose what turned out to be a limited Medicare, first to propose regulation of the security markets, first to propose a whole slew of changes in our country that one or two of the major parties decades later finally picked up on. So they have an independent. They're not allowed to win at the national level, but they have an independent.
So they're not allowed to win, but
very useful.
Right, but they have a useful role. What do you think about that, Evan? And do you want to respond to what Rob
Well,
Nader's
I mean,
about?
It's a fair point. I think when we're facing a crisis like we are right now in our country, we don't have the luxury to say, you know, over the course of a few decades, if we organize in this way, we might have an influence on some aspect of policy. We've got issues of separation of powers. We've got issues of equal rights. We've got issues of voting, whether people are going to be allowed to vote, our national security. And we need an organization that's strong enough to stand up to the excesses of Trump and to also deal with these deep-seated, important, underlying economic issues our country faces that working families face. Third parties aren't strong enough to do that. They're just not. And I think Mr. Nader certainly would concede that. So the question is, what do we do? And that's why I've chosen, we've got to get the Democratic Party to change. And that happens from within. Bernie Sanders is doing that. But we need people from all across the political spectrum to say, we're going to stand up for American values, and we're going to fight for working families and make sure we've got an economy and a country that's fair and meets our aspirations.
Ralph Nader, can the Democratic Party change from within? I mean, if people like Evan Falchuk, who sort of were on the outside, come back in and say, all right, we're going to get serious about this and change it in meaningful ways. Does that give you confidence?
Point is, look, we really have a crisis here. Let's be real. So we only have two parties, and we got to focus on the Democratic Party. My answer to that is the following, and it echoes Bill Curry's pithy comment that the Democrats...
Bill Curry, Ralph Nader, we should tell our listeners who Bill Curry is. He's a former comptroller of the state of Connecticut. He ran unsuccessfully for governor a couple of times, and I know he's a friend of yours. He's also someone that I've known for a while.
He made a very pithy statement. He said the Democrats had a very efficient transition from Nancy Pelosi to Nancy Pelosi. Four-time loser, 2010, 12, 14, 16, losing to the worst Republican Party in history, instead of landsliding the worst Republican Party in history. So what am I saying? I'm saying that the lure of money, with both parties dialing for the same commercial dollars, both parties willing to gerrymander and deprive the voters of even two viable choices, they are becoming more and more alike. The only way to change the Democratic Party is to throw out the old guard and put new energy and new people from the local to the state to the national.
Agreed.
You are not going to change the old guard Democratic Party. You're not. Believe me, I've been watching this for years. There is no penalty in the Democratic Party for losing.
So you agree with that?
Well, I do, and I would invite Ralph Nader to join us in this, because we do need to change that old guard leadership. When I joined, I've made it very clear that the Democrats are getting me, meaning that I'm going to speak my mind. The things that I believed in when I was organizing UIP is something that will continue as a Democrat. And we need all the help we can get. It is a crisis that we're facing, and we need all that help.
Evan, Ralph Nader, let me invite some callers into this conversation. We've got a lot of them who've got some questions and some comments. Let's go to David, who's calling from Acton. Hi, David. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Glad to be here.
Tell me what's on your mind.
Yeah, so I think we need third parties, but the easiest way to achieve it is simply change the voting system to a single transferable voting system like they have in Europe in many places. What you do is you vote 1, 2, 3 in order of your preference, but your vote gets transferred if your person gets eliminated. That way, if somebody wants to vote for Ralph Nader, they can do that. But then if he gets the lowest votes, those votes are transferred back to whoever you chose second. That's what would make third parties viable. It's a very simple system, and it would really revolutionize American democracy.
And that's exactly why the Democrats are opposing single, exactly what you're talking about.
Ranked choice voting, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's in San Francisco. It's in some cities. But that raises a fundamental issue. As you start rebuilding the Democratic Party at the local level, you start flooding the town meetings of members of Congress and the Democratic Party. I mean, people are now showing up. Showing up's half of democracy. Scares the heck out of these politicians who are used to empty seats for their town meetings that aren't filled by anyone other than their staff and their cronies, and they control it. And when you have 1,000 people showing up to Congressman Jason Chaffetz, Republican in Utah, with 200 outside, can't get in, opposing his proposal to sell off some of the public lands, that's beginning to happen for the Democrats as well. So there's a lot of heat that can build up, so you don't have to wait until the next election.
Yep.
And indeed, if you do wait until the next election and not build up the heat between elections on substantive issues, you're not going to have much success.
Mm. Let's go to David, who's calling from the South End in Boston. David, what's on your mind? Good to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me. And Mr. Nader, I voted for you back in 2000. I just was going to comment on the fact that, you know, it's Coke versus Pepsi. There's two large corporations battling it out, suppressing the RC Colas and the small players. And I'm just looking at the national level. So to me, it's two big businesses that are holding down smaller businesses from being able to express themselves and rise up. And that last caller made a great point. And to keep the Davids, it's the Davids versus the Goliaths, really. And you know, the Republicans and Democrats just are going to do their best to stop a third party.
But David, I mean, I'd love to know where you come down. I mean, Evan Falchuk's point is, you know, it's one or the other. And in the age of Donald Trump, are you really prepared to just sort of say these are two parties that are like Coke and Pepsi?
Yeah, it's a good question. I honestly don't know. It's a pretty big risk at the present time, I think, to go out on a limb and vote for Ms. Stein, not that she maybe was the best candidate at the time for a third party. Had there been a better option in that sphere, I probably would have gone there.
This is why self-government is very hard, is that we have to make these choices. We have to. And so when we're faced with choices we don't like, we can either bail out and not participate, which is a big problem, or we can, and I believe this is terms that Ralph Nader's used, we got to give a damn. We got to get involved. We got to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Right. But are you suggesting that voting third party is sort of bailing out?
It can be. Yeah. There were situations in this last election in 2016 where both Gary Johnson and Jill Stein had an impact on where the race went, and they did it for their own reasons. I'm not really sure what they were, but we have a problem on our hands today. Let's look forward.
Well, Ralph,
there's a new variable though coming up in 2020. A lot of enlightened billionaires are looking at Donald Trump and saying, "Well, if he could make it to the White House, given his drawbacks, why can't we?" And a third party driven by a billionaire can turn the race into a three-way contest. I mean, Perot almost did that even after he dropped out and came back in 1992. He got 19 million votes, but he didn't get one electoral college vote. So we do have a variety of opposition. The most immediate thing is just to turn out, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Turn out to these town meetings. If they're not there, you schedule your own town meeting and you summon your senators and representatives to your own. In my new book, Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, I've drafted a formal summons from the people to the two senators and representatives to come to town meetings arranged by the people with the agenda by the people, so they have to respond. And it's a lot easier than you think. There's so much apathy in this country that if a senator walks into an auditorium and sees it full, the first thing the senator says is, "Holy smoke, what's going on here?" And you can see it already occurring in the last few weeks on Obamacare, on the public lands, on other matters that people perceive as being taken from them. Something they have now is being taken from them. And that's the great provocative value of Donald Trump.
Well, I want to go back, Ralph Nader, if I could, because Evan Falchuk raised this point of Gary Johnson, Jill Stein having an impact on the election. Some might even say spoiler. I know you faced criticism of being a spoiler in 2000. What's the response to that? I mean, if political advocacy and getting involved and participating, which I completely understand and I admire you for, encouraging everybody to do that. Do third parties, though, sometimes cause more trouble than they're worth because of this spoiler
role? Under a system of incarceration of the American voter by the two pro-business indentured parties. I mean, the very idea that a spoiled political system being challenged by a clean, progressive third party It's just a matter of using bigoted words. Call somebody a spoiler who's trying to clean up politics because that person dares to challenge this two-party duopoly is servile thinking. It's political servitude. We're better than that as a country.
Well, you know, one of the challenges is that change has to happen starting at the local level. And when we have people running at the presidential level, it's they can't win, and then those votes end up being having an impact in the overall election. And it makes people not want to participate. So, look, I think that Ralph's point about showing up to these meetings with your legislative leaders is hugely important. It's one thing that I know people in the Democratic Party have to get used to doing. The Trump people did it. Believe me, when I see people in Congress not acting to do something against the excesses of Trump, it's because they know they're going to go home and there's a meeting full of Trump supporters telling them to keep going. Mm. So as Democrats, as Americans, we've got to participate, we've got to be involved, and we've got to hold our leaders accountable to our Constitution and our way of life.
Evan Falchuk, Ralph Nader, let's just take one more call because we've still got the lines full and I'd like to get at least one more in. Mike is calling from Santa Monica, California. Great that you're listening to Radio Boston out there in Santa Monica, Mike.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a former Green mayor, and I worked on Ralph's 96 and 2000 campaign. I just want to add that I think it's already a failed experiment to try and reform the Democrats. And in addition to choice voting for executive office like president or governor, we should have multi-seat districts with proportional representation for the legislature. It's ridiculous for the Sanders people to think they're going to go in and have a civil war with the DLC people in every district around the country. They should be in their own party. And in a proportional representation system, they would have it. Probably most of them would be in the Green Party.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks for that call. Well, Evan, let me sort of put Mike's point to you. I mean, I know we're talking about, he's talking about sort of a national view, but here you are in Massachusetts. Is it a lost cause to join the Democrats?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
It's something that we have to do if we care about what the future looks like. You know, all these ideas are great. I'm in favor of ranked choice voting and all that, but the people who would put it into place are the ones who benefit from the current system. So if you're a person who cares about seeing more people, new people, more dynamic democracy, you've got to be in one of the parties to make it happen. You just have to be, and you got to participate.
The
citizens have got to say to themselves, we want power.
Yep.
We have put enormous power in the hands of members of Congress and the presidency. Enormous delegated power, which is being used against us. We should take it personally. The point is, when you show up at these meetings, you get empowered. You show how thin the system is in Washington, how they're skating on ice as they collect dollars from Wall Street to Houston for their campaigns. But you see, if you don't do it from the bottom up like that and get more people to run for office, local, state, and national, and make it a real competitive democracy, what's going to happen is more and more the two parties will be alike. They're dialing for the same campaign dollars. They're pushing for the same gerrymandering. They're afraid of the same interest groups. And this will only get worse unless people take it in their own hands. So if you have a complaint about politics, folks, look in the mirror if you don't show up.
Okay. All right.
Amen. Well said.
Well said, Ralph Nader. Evan Falchuk, the last time I was sitting across this table from you, you were running for governor with the United Independent Party. You're a Democrat now. Are you going to run for governor?
I want to do all the things Ralph just said. I want to get people involved. I want to get people elected to office. We'll see where I fit into that picture.
All right. Evan Falchuk, he was founder of the United Independent Party. He's a Democrat now. And Ralph Nader, lawyer, author, consumer advocate, former presidential candidate. His latest book is Breaking Through Power. It's Easier Than We Think. Ralph Nader, Evan Falchuk, thank you both very much. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brooks.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In a moment, we're going to talk about America's long love affair with lethal self-defense. But first, a case in point. New Hampshire is poised to join 11 other states, including Maine and Vermont, that allow people to carry concealed weapons without a permit. The New Hampshire House and Senate have both approved the NRA-backed bill, and Republican Governor Chris Sununu has indicated that he'll sign it. His predecessor, Democrat Maggie Hassan, who's now a senator, vetoed similar bills twice in the past. The law is opposed by many chiefs of police in New Hampshire, including Albert Brackett, the top cop in the town of Atkinson.
My biggest concern is there's a lot of people that will be carrying firearms concealed that really shouldn't be. You know, people who have mental health issues, people who have a history of domestic violence but no convictions on their record, and those individuals the biggest issue that I see is they haven't been vetted to determine whether they're suitable to carry a firearm. Listen, the system right now works well. It's been working well for scores of years. Probably.
And Chief Brackett, remind us how that system works right now.
The way it works now is we do an investigation into the information that you provide us. It starts with a criminal history record check. It may show me, I'll give you an example of an individual who's been arrested over, say, 7 or 8 years on three different occasions of domestic violence and intimidation of a witness, and those charges end up being dismissed in court. Well, when I look at that arrest history, that concerns me. So we would look into it further. So we'd ask for the police reports. Police reports, a lot of time we get the restraining orders from the courts, and the court shows a restraining order was put in effect and all their firearms were taken away from them for a period of time until the charges were dismissed. So an individual like that, I would determine is not suitable to carry a concealed firearm, and I would deny the permit.
Right.
Under the new system, we don't even look at the individual. They're just allowed to carry a firearm concealed. There's no vetting system at all in place.
Yeah, so it's quite a change. Now Chief Brackett, as you know, folks who favor this law, gun rights advocates, say that the way the law is now gave folks like you too much power, that you can use your power arbitrarily, be too subjective in some cases in denying someone a permit. What do you say to those concerns?
Well, that's not the case because it's an appeal process. So say, as a chief, I look at somebody's arrest record and I deny it. They have a right to go to a court before a judge, and the judge determines whether the individual is suitable and can override my decision. And that happens. It happens on a regular basis. I've had 26 denials in the last 3 years, and I've probably been to court 8 or 9 times, and it really doesn't give the chief a lot of power other than, listen, to do the right thing for my community and do the right thing for other people in the state. I think what was good about the process, the way it is now, till the law has passed, is that it's a process where we can weed out people that shouldn't be carrying a firearm. They're a threat to the community.
With this new law in place, aren't there federal restrictions on buying a firearm that would still apply? So aren't there still some kinds of protections in place to make sure people who shouldn't have guns won't have guns?
The only issue with that is that they only look at convictions on their criminal history. So if you go to a gun store and you purchase a gun, they run your name through the gun line, and the gun line comes back. You have no felony convictions, but you could have 10, 12, 15 arrests for various violent crimes where the charges were dismissed or they were continued without a finding, and there's no felony on your record. So that doesn't vet those people out. All that does is it vet out people who are convicted felons.
Right. On the other hand, I could imagine some people listening to this interview and saying, but really what we're talking about is due process here. You know, you act on a hunch because you're a law enforcement officer, but isn't due process really about someone actually having committed a crime and therefore he or she should be punished by not being able to have a gun? I mean, do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes. Well, the way the law is currently written is whether a person's suitable or not, and that's all we do is, listen, you know, we get the application, we do an investigation.
Got it.
That's not done under this new law. There's no investigation. There's no vetting process. We do a fair investigation and determine that we don't think a person is suitable. And then the due process is you have the right to have a hearing before a judge.
So what's your message to the New Hampshire legislature? I mean, what would you like these legislators to really understand about this?
Well, I don't think they understand the gravity of what they're doing. I think that I think it's dangerous. I think that with all of the violence that we have in society, we need to have some system in place that we can vet out people who have the potential for violence against other citizens. And I think that this just eliminates something that we've had that's been working for a long time. And that's my message to the legislature is I don't think they put enough thought into it. And I don't think that they took into consideration, people that have mental health issues here in the state. And there's no system in place to determine whether those people are getting firearms. It's not a good recipe for keeping the people in our state safe.
All right. Well, Albert Brackett is the chief of police in Atkinson, New Hampshire. Chief Brackett, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. We're very grateful.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, the New Hampshire bill is a prime example of what Harvard historian Carolyn Light calls the do-it-yourself security citizenship movement, a movement to take self-defense, sometimes lethal self-defense, into our own hands. She's written a book about the subject called Stand Your Ground, The History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Defense, and she joins us now in the studio. And Carolyn Light, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
I'd love it if you could just give me a quick definition of what is do-it-yourself security citizenship.
Essentially, it's the idea that you must take your own safety into your own hands because nobody else is going to do it for you. Yeah. Not the government, not law enforcement, nobody but you. And it is also based on the idea that you must kill or be killed. Be prepared to take someone else's life because you are always under threat. So it's based on a lot of anxiety and fear.
Yeah, and very much sort of at the heart of this debate about guns and gun ownership and gun rights, which we were just talking with Chief Brackett about. I'd love to start with some history because this is, among other things, a history book. Bring us back to English common law, which was the law of the land, and what it said about this kind of lethal self-defense.
So I try to go back as far as I can, back to before there was a United States. And there was a legal doctrine about the duty to retreat. Human life was valued to the point that if you were under attack from someone, you were obligated to retreat to the wall behind your back before you met force with force. Hmm. This was encoded into English common law. You weren't allowed to fight back lethally. The one exception to that was known as the Castle Doctrine. This originates in the early 1600s in England, again, with the idea that a man's house is his castle. In other words, if someone attacked you in your house, you could fight back with lethal force. That was the one exception.
Right. But of course, that means this right of lethal self-defense is connected to home ownership. And of course, there weren't a lot of folks with a home who owned a home, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was from the get-go a selective kind of self-defense ideology. It was based on property ownership and citizenship, full citizenship, which was absolutely all about race and gender and class. There were certain people who enjoyed the full rights, privileges, and protections of full citizenship, and those were a minority of the population.
Really interesting. So your book is called Stand Your Ground, The History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Defense. And so we've moved from that idea of it being sort of understood that you must and should retreat if you can to this idea of stand your ground, right?
Right, absolutely.
So what gave rise to this movement in America?
Oh, my. So it's a long story, but I try to go back to the very beginning of the United States and the ideas that, for instance, European-descended men, settler colonialism, the idea that there was a particular right imbued in European masculinity to spread civilization from sea to shining sea, the idea of manifest destiny, and the way in which that was incommensurable with this idea that men should retreat in the face of danger. So the Castle Doctrine gradually expanded beyond the boundaries of the private home when you get into what would become the United States. Particularly, I spent a lot of time talking about the post-Civil War era Reconstruction as African Americans are at least on the surface given freedom, given citizenship, and as men are enfranchised with the 15th Amendment, we start to see pushback in the form of the expansion of the Castle Doctrine for white men in particular in the wake of Reconstruction. So this trend continues up to the point where we are right now, to make a long story short, where in approximately 33 states, we have different versions of the Stand Your Ground laws that on the surface endow anyone with the right to fight back with lethal self-defense wherever
now, why on
they
the,
can be.
Why on the surface? Why on the surface? You're
why
suggesting surface? That not everybody is imbued with that same right.
No, our laws are not colorblind the way they are adjudicated. If you look on the surface of the law, it sounds like it's race and gender blind. Mm-hmm. Any man, woman, whoever who is threatened can fight back with lethal self-defense. But if you look at the way the laws are adjudicated in those states with the Stand Your Ground law, you can see that they very much favor white men who are fighting against or fighting back against claiming self-defense against minority people, particularly men, but not only.
A case in point, for example, it's been 5 years since the shooting death of Trevon Martin, 17 years old in Florida, by George Zimmerman, who claimed self-defense. He was found not guilty. That's a real example of that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, essentially, staying your ground is a selective license to kill for people who can claim that they were fighting back for fear of their own, you know, danger or a threat of on their life. But what it amounts to really is this notion of kill or be killed for specific kinds of so-called law-abiding citizens, but not for others.
There's something else you write in here that's really intriguing. You write that defensively armed citizen has become, in some quarters, the paragon of patriotism, unquote, which suggests that self-defense has gone from a right to a duty almost.
Absolutely. Yeah. In many quarters, and I would say gun rights activists epitomize this ideology that to be a good citizen, you need to be an armed citizen. But as we've seen with so many people like Philando Castile this summer, there are certain kinds of people, and in his case, a black man who was legally carrying a firearm was seen as a criminal threat by law enforcement. So that's the ideal. The ideal is that to be a good citizen, you must be armed and prepared to fight back for your life. In reality, however, it's a very selectively upheld right.
Today, in the U.S., gun rights inevitably seem linked to partisan politics. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a cause. Gun rights are a cause for many conservative Republicans. I mean, these are generalizations, but it's as far as generalizations go, it's a pretty good one for liberal Democrats. They generally favor tighter gun regulations. Was this always so?
It was not. And actually, it's really complicated. The partisan politics around do-it-yourself security citizenship are really complicated. I try in my book to signal just how complicated, to give you a really interesting exception to the sort of partisan idea that gun rights are the province of a more conservative leaning people. There's an organization that originated in 2015 called the Black Women's Defense League in Dallas. And they are very much about progressively protecting African-American women from both white supremacy, which is still very pervasive in our nation, and patriarchy and misogynist violence. These are women who exist at that intersection and who are fighting back by arming themselves and protecting themselves. So I want to balance the way we're thinking about this by looking at the nuance involved in do-it-yourself security citizenship. It isn't just gun rights. It isn't just the NRA. There are also people. The Pink Pistols are another good example. LGBTQ identified folks who are investing time and energy in learning how to protect themselves, not just with guns, but in other ways too. Being aware of their surroundings, being aware of the existence of hate crimes, people who are homophobic and violently so, particularly right here and now. So, yes, there's a partisan element to it, but I don't want to simplify it because there certainly are other folks who are, I would say, progressive-minded folks who are invested in arming themselves. I do want to say, however, the law does not come down on their side. Marissa Alexander, recently released from house arrest, a black woman who defended herself with a warning shot, ended up serving time in jail. She, in her case, prosecution couldn't imagine that she was reasonably afraid for her safety.
I'm curious, you know, looking at your title, America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense, it is such a uniquely American phenomenon. But let me ask you that. Is it? Are there other countries that have such a love affair with this idea of lethal self-defense?
I don't think there's any that compare to the United States. When you look at our statistics, the number of guns we have in this nation have surpassed the number of human beings in the nation. The number of mass violent shootings, way more than any other comparable nation. We are absolutely unique in the sense of seeing lethal self-defense as a right, and also in the proliferation of guns as a solution to security threats.
In literally the sort of 20 seconds or so we have left, what do you hope people will take away by understanding this history? Because this is such an issue that is imbued with such fraught debate. What do you hope people take away?
I want them to think about the uncomfortable past that has paved the way to where we are now, and to think really critically, self-critically, about our investment in lethal self-defense.
That's Carolyn Light. She's the director of the Undergraduate Studies in Studies of Women at Harvard, and her new book is called Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Defense. Carolyn Light, thank you so much. What a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.